Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Rachel Pels about the new book, Genomics, How Genome Sequencing Will Change Healthcare. Genome sequencing is one of the most exciting scientific breakthroughs of the past 30 years. But what precisely does it involve and how is it developing? Rachel Pels addresses the fundamental question: to what extent will future advances transform human longevity and the quality of life? Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Galina, how are you?
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What do you do?
Sure. So I'm a freelance journalist. I'm based in London in the UK, and I write about science and research mainly. Mostly for newspapers and magazines, and recently for books as well.
And how did you get interested in journalism?
That's a good question. I always enjoyed writing, even from when I was very small. I loved writing stories, and it sort of felt natural, I think. I don't know if there was ever a moment when I decided, yes, I'm going to be a journalist, but I did English literature in school, and then I did a master's degree in journalism after that. Started doing some internships and eventually got a job in journalism, and yeah, I love it. I haven't looked back.
And what brought you to science journalism?
Yeah, the funny thing is, I wasn't very good at science in school. I don't know. It's my parents sort of laugh at the fact that I'm now a science journalist. So I think I've always been interested in science, but maybe when you're younger, biology and chemistry for me were sort of taught in a way that it didn't have much connection to the real world. You just follow a textbook a lot of the time. I don't have a science background as such, but the long story short is that I had a job as a journalist, obviously, for an education magazine called Times Higher Education. And my role there was to write about research from the perspective of the researchers themselves, so life as an academic. And that was really enjoyable for a couple of years, but I found myself increasingly interested in wanting to learn about the actual science rather than writing about the process of doing the science, if that makes sense. I was meeting so many interesting people working in sciences, and I just really wanted to write about that directly and sort of explore some of the big things that are impacting the world. Then I went freelance. I left my job at Times Higher so that I could pursue this sort of broader remit looking at science. And I used to have a slight imposter syndrome about it. I don't come from a science background, but I do think that there is value in being a layperson almost, because I can hopefully translate the science in a way that makes it accessible to most people, if that's a very long-winded way of answering you.
Hmm. And I was wondering then, do you enjoy this kind of process of discovery? Because as I imagine, you have to learn about all different scientific fields if you're writing an article.
Yeah, I think I have a lot of admiration for the researchers themselves, because I think one of the good things about being a journalist is that you can dip into lots of different subjects. You don't have to commit your entire career to finding out the answer to one thing. So I really enjoy sort of learning about lots of different new things. And keeping it sort of broad within science, obviously, but it's interesting, and there's so much to discover. It's there's never an opportunity to get bored with it.
And what would you say to our student listeners and maybe early career people who might have not had best grades in biology and chemistry when they were in school, but still are interested in having something to do with science?
Yeah, of course. I think, I'm living proof that you can definitely have a career in that sort of relates to science. You know, you can translate the science, you can be involved without being a scientist. I think there's a really sort of important role in translating the science that happens. A lot of it sort of gets missed by the public because, you know, scientists are busy, they're actually in the lab, or they don't necessarily have the skills that it takes to talk about it openly. I think science journalism is a really nice sort of crossover between those two worlds. You know, you can be a writer and enjoy the art while also learning about science and sort of learning, being involved from that perspective.
So your new book is Genomics, How Genome Sequencing Will Change Healthcare. And how did you come to writing it?
It started with an article that I wrote for Wired magazine back in, I think, 2018 or 19. I should check that. It was back in 2019. This was actually the first article that I pitched as a freelance journalist. This is all relevant, I promise. It was about, there's some research going on in the Francis Crick Institute in London, where I live, where the cancer researchers are taking quite an unusual step in they're using autopsy, so from dead bodies of people who sadly died of cancer, they get their consent when they are alive, and they can take samples from their bodies when they passed away and use genomic sequencing to basically kind of uncover some of the secrets about how cancer works. And it's a really interesting project. It's called the PEACE Project, if anybody is interested in reading about it. And that was my first introduction to genomics. I don't think I really had heard of it properly before then. But of course, that opened up this whole other world. The technology can be applied across so many different subjects. And luckily for me, Wired were planning a series of books, a sort of short introduction to lots of big topics. And they asked if I'd be interested in writing one. So I said, of course, and suggested genomics as a potential topic.
All right, so let's dive into the book. And can we start with the very basics? So what is genomics?
So genomics is the study of all of our thousands of genes. So a genome is basically a map of all of those genes and all of the billions of DNA that we have, all of our biological coding and information, everything that's just that go around our bodies and the things that sort of make us human is the way that I like to think about it. Genomics is the study of all of that. So the sort of uncovering of what our DNA is up to, what it all means, how it pieces together, and learning more about how, learning more about ourselves, I think is a good way of looking at it.
And how did it all start?
Genomics. Yeah, it's actually not very old at all. This is the thing. So a lot of people, when I talk about it, they'll say, oh, I feel silly because I've never actually heard of it, or they might have heard of it, but they don't know much about genomics. And I think that's totally reasonable because genomics hasn't really been around for that long. It sort of started in 1990. There was a big moonshot initiative called the Human Genome Project. And it was backed by the US and the UK governments and a few places after that. And basically they wanted to create a map of all of the genes that make us human and have it on a record. So create like a blueprint of our bodies. And it was a massive project. It cost close to $3 billion and it involved researchers from all over the world, all working together to produce this big map. And they did it sort of collaboratively over about 10 years. They thought it would take a lot longer, but it became quite competitive towards the end. People wanted to get it wrapped up before some private companies could sort of take it over. The result is that we have this full map of the human genome. It's been replaced since then. You know, we've got much more adept and much faster at sequencing our DNA. So the map is much more detailed now. It took, so I think the fact that it took sort of thousands of researchers all across the world and industry as well getting involved, I think it's something to celebrate. It's a really interesting team science example, I think.
Yeah, the Human Genome Project, it was a big deal, wasn't it, when it was finished?
Yeah, definitely. I can sort of, well, I don't remember it, but I've seen the clips of, I think, the world leaders like Tony Blair and George Bush kind of coming out onto the stage and announcing it. And there was a kind of excitement at the time. I think, you know, we've cracked the code and we're going to suddenly be able to solve all of our health problems and create perfect children and all of these things. It hasn't happened quite yet, but it's definitely getting there. I think, you know, genomics is really helping to further our understanding of a lot of the world.
So what are some of the tools that researchers and scientists use in genomic technology, basically?
Oh, you mean like the actual sort of machinery? That is very complicated. And I do sort of touch on it in the book, but I don't know if I'm the best person to explain because it's so complicated, I think, to an outsider as a sort of non-scientist. But the way that I, you know, in very layperson's terms, the way I'll describe it is they can take a sample of your blood or sometimes saliva and run it through this machine, which will sort of map out to show you, you know, all the base pairs of the DNA, which they can then sort of piece together to work out what goes where. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, for sure. So they use those sequencing machines to sequence DNA, and then it has to be combined with the computational power as well, isn't it, to reconstruct it all?
Yeah, so a lot of it's automated now, and that's made a really big difference because back in the day, researchers would sit and do this by hand, which would take a very long time. But now we have computers to do a lot of that quite sort of mundane work for us. And in terms of tools, there are lots of advances that are happening. So you've probably heard of CRISPR, which is one of several tools now that allows us to actually go into a strand of DNA and edit it, which is very exciting.
So how did genomics find its way into our healthcare and how we think about our health?
Yeah, I think several ways. The technology is obviously fairly new, but there are lots of different applications of it already. So the fact that we have the map of our human genome means that when people carry certain health conditions, scientists can actually see which mutations are responsible and where they are in our genome. And because we know we can pinpoint that, it means that we can potentially go in and change that particular bit of coding and therefore, you know, eradicate the disease, maybe find better ways of treating it, which all sounds very much like science fiction, but it's possible. It's tricky. It's, you know, they are starting to bring out lots of treatments, certainly in the way of like cancer therapies. But we, at the moment, we're not, scientists are not going in to edit the human DNA itself because we don't know the long-term sort of consequences of that always. It's still something that, you know, it's a case of the science is maybe a little bit further ahead than our ethical and moral understanding of it, if that makes sense. I can give you a good example. There's the cystic fibrosis. It's caused by a single gene mutation. And it means that scientists can actually see exactly where the problem lies, if you like. And in the future, even now, a baby could be born and they could have a little tiny blood test, and they can, they can see whether they are carrying this disease, whether they are likely to be impacted by it. And potentially that means that if a baby is born with cystic fibrosis now, they we could sort of make them undergo a certain procedure, a surgical procedure to eradicate it, and then they'll live a full and healthy life, which on paper sounds fantastic. But there are lots of course, questions around that, because a lot of people who live with diseases and other disabilities will argue that actually their lives are very valuable. And once we start deciding which disability is okay and which one isn't, it's a really, really tricky issue. So yeah, to answer your question, there are lots of ways in which genomics is impacting our health. Some of the things we are a little bit far away from at the moment, but it's definitely making a difference in terms of the medications that we can receive and how we can see exactly how effectively medicines are affecting our genome personally. So the differences in treatment between you and me, for example.
So it's kind of paves the way for the personalized medicine, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And that's the big dream, is that one day perhaps we'll all be on this kind of database where we'll all have our DNA sequenced, and it means that when we go to the doctors to get them to prescribe something for a problem, they can possibly just check that against this database and work out, okay, well, this medicine will work well for you for these reasons, this one not so much. And it means that hopefully we'll recover from things quicker, we'll have a much faster process in being treated for things as well, and public healthcare will be more efficient. That's the dream anyway, we're still getting there.
Yeah, it's really interesting how genomics can contribute to sort of finding out and alleviating some of the suffering due to the monogenic diseases. So are we able to quantify risks of these diseases that can be caused by multiplicity of genes and their interactions using genomics, or not yet?
Yes. Let me just find my answers. So it's yes, to answer your question. There's such a thing as a polygenic risk score, which are used by some companies to sort of indicate the likelihood of gene mutations. For example, for couples going through IVF, they can look at the likelihood of one of their embryos carrying different mutations that are possibly inherited. So there are sort of used in other areas of biology to determine sort of how an organism's health compares to another's. So you can have this polygenic score to sort of help improve the chances of a healthy organism. A better way of explaining it, so they actually already use polygenic scores for selective breeding in livestock, for example. Farmers can have a sort of score to determine, okay, this is a healthy animal for these reasons, this one carries a risk of carrying these diseases, so we'll use this healthier animal to breed with. You can see where it becomes a little bit difficult when we start to try and apply that to humans, because again, there are lots of ethical quandaries there. And it's worth saying as well that polygenic risk scores are, you know, they are just a score. They don't take into account the environmental impact that the environmental reasons for health problems. So we, you know, we can develop a disease or some condition because it's in our genes, but that is also impacted by our diet and our lifestyle, by our level of poverty, lots of other things. So it's very much not a perfect system.
So it all has to be taken in the context, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good example to sort of show that, yes, this is a whole new area of research, and their technology can be really helpful in answering lots of health questions, but it's not a one size fits all solution. It's not this sort of magic silver bullet that's going to solve all of our health problems. We have to also concentrate on improving people's lifestyles and general well-being.
And coming to these factors which are outside our bodies, so how can genomics contribute to, for example, agriculture?
Good question. That's really exciting. I mean, on the one hand, it's quite bleak. You'll probably have seen the statistics saying that. I think the UN sort of warns that because we're going to have a global population of about 10 billion people by 2050, there's going to be potentially a really big food security issue, you know, food shortages by that point. If we need to feed all these people, we're also battling climate change. So genomics can help in quite a few ways here, and it's really exciting. It's already taking place in countries across Africa, for example. They can use gene editing to make certain crops and food items grow better. So there are different strands of corn now that have been sort of artificially, you know, genetically modified so that they can resist extreme heat, for example. That means that if there's a drought, they are at less risk of having a famine because they will still be able to feed people. Really simple stuff, but that's also applicable in other areas. You know, we can go into tomato plants now, and they make them sort of, you know, genetically modify them so that they can contain vitamin D. That's a way of making them more nutritious. It's really exciting. I think it's still, again, it's interesting that Europe in particular is not so much behind gene editing of crops yet, because they are, it sort of carries a lot of taboo still. People a few years ago were worried about the health consequences of quote unquote messing with nature in this way. But, you know, the WHO has confirmed that there is no health risk to genetically modified foods. It's all very safe if it's properly. And it's also going to be necessary, I think, in the future, because if we are going to make sure that we all have enough food, especially with climate change impacting the way that we grow things and our different climates, changing the food that we can grow, we're going to have to turn to science to help tweak little things in the genome of those plants just to make sure that they continue to thrive and that we can continue to eat them. So yeah, there's lots going on. And yeah, that it's something that I think Europe is considering, I should say.
And perhaps precision editing technologies like CRISPR, for example, they maybe even have much better possibility to be accepted, I suppose, by our governments and people, because you're not putting something extra into the organism, you're just tweaking the sequence a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I think in the past, people have had this, they've been maybe scared of the idea of genetic modification because, you know, you've probably seen cartoons like on The Simpsons where there's a three-eyed fish and people have these ideas about what genetic modification is, whether it's creating something really alien. But actually, a lot of the time, it's just, as you say, it's just using things like CRISPR to snip a little bit of the DNA coding in a plant. You could go in, you could introduce a gene that makes it more resistant to drought. And it's not unnatural per se. It's just, I guess, giving nature a helping hand. But some people would disagree.
Yeah, for sure. And hopefully that can contribute to more sustainable agriculture as well, isn't it?
Exactly. It makes the carbon emissions from farming much more, it can reduce the carbon emissions in farming because it's more streamlined, it's more efficient, there's less time wasted on crops and management of different foods that don't work out. So yeah, it's better for the planet as well.
So then how can genomics contribute to our battle with the change in our climate?
Yeah, hopefully in several ways. So we've already mentioned the crops and agriculture. There's also a lot of research happening in plants, you know, biotechnology, in the same way that we can edit these crops to be more nutritious or withstand drought and flooding and things. We can also give plants a helping hand to suck up more carbon in the atmosphere. So there's a really interesting project taking place in California right now called... I just completely skipped my mind. I will find out. There's a really interesting, it's the California Institute of Technology. They have this project where they can go into the genome of certain plants and encourage them to selectively breed, if you like. They'll sort of encourage selective breeding of plants that already carry this ability to suck up more carbon from the atmosphere than other plants. So if the idea is that if they can encourage more of those plants to be born with this particular gene, plants will automatically become better at carbon capture. They can also do it so that plants, you know, they improve the soil that they're in because they are also holding a lot more of that carbon in the soil. It's yeah, there are lots of different, like, lots of potential avenues for this. In coral reefs, for example, again, it's all sort of derived from things that already naturally occur. So there are certain corals that can withstand heat better than others. And that's going to be really useful for when sea temperatures rise, as they are in a lot of tropical places. So scientists can work out exactly what genes the plants have that make them better at withstanding that heat. They can selectively breed and encourage more plants to be born with those particular traits, and therefore kind of just help them along to make sure that they continue to survive and to thrive, And therefore, there's a knock-on effect. So if we can protect corals, we can protect the rest of the reef and all of the organisms that live on that reef. It's all connected.
Now thinking about the changing climate and changing habitats, especially of mosquitoes, for example, the ones who can carry diseases like malaria. So genomics can also help in that battle as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that's the whole, there's so many different avenues, aren't there, to talk about. So mosquitoes, scientists are editing them to, you can prevent them from carrying malaria, which obviously kills millions of people. And that's because they have been, sequencing the genome of the disease itself, and also they can sequence the mosquitoes to work out what it is about them that allows them to carry this disease. And they can edit it out if they want to. And that's huge and really impactful for human health. But the question is whether it would throw our ecosystem out of whack. So, mosquitoes are just one example, but there is a lot of scientists do sort of warn that if we change one thing, we don't always know what the consequences are. A lot of the time, when particularly when it comes to viruses and things, and even in ourselves in humans, when our genes seemingly go wrong, it's not always that they are going wrong. It's just a part of the evolution. There might be a reason why, or another benefit as to why we've evolved that way. So there might be evolutionary reasons why mosquitoes have become able to carry malaria. And if we remove that ability, who knows, are we going to then sort of unbalance the ecosystem? It's a really interesting question. Like a lot of things, we haven't been experimenting with gene editing for very long, so we don't know the sort of long-term consequences of this. But I have no doubt that in the next few years, some very clever people will be able to forecast things a lot better, and we might be able to say, yes, great, let's eradicate malaria by letting it out of mosquitoes, or not.
Yeah, and it really underlines the complexity of all of it. And even when you have the mosquito that has the bacterium that transmits the malaria, you have to look at the carrier as well, like a human who have different genetics, their genomes are different. And if they have one allele of the sickle cell disease, they have different susceptibility, isn't it? So you have to look at the whole, like the whole environment.
Yeah, exactly. We're all connected. It's all interconnected. And we don't know the full picture of our sort of evolutionary reasons for that. There's another good example, actually. There was a story, I think, in The Atlantic that I was reading recently about a man in Canada who had this very rare and horrible disease. It's called cystinosis. And I think he would have died from it eventually anyway. It's a horrible disease we don't have a cure for. So he volunteered to take part in this quite experimental treatment, a gene therapy, where basically scientists can try and reintroduce the working gene to replace the defective one, the one that causes this disease. And so he took part, and a lot of the symptoms that he suffered from eased up. But then there was this really unexpected result in that he was originally naturally very blonde, and at the end of his treatment, his hair completely changed colour. So I think it fell out and it came back really dark brown, almost black. It's just a story. It doesn't matter too much. I mean, hopefully he didn't mind too much that his hair changed colour. It's seemingly just an aesthetic thing, but it does just goes to show that we don't always know the outcomes of changing things in our DNA. It's just hair colour, but we don't know that if we were to remove one thing or replace it with a different thing, it could have potentially an adverse effect on something that's actually really useful for the rest of our bodies. So yeah, it's a very long-winded way of saying that it's a very fine balance, and we don't know exactly how it works yet, so we have to be quite careful.
For sure. And this brings me to my next question about the ethics and something that you mentioned earlier. So for the humans, it's really a taboo to edit our genome in the germline, basically, so in germline cells. But something like that happened, hasn't it, recently?
Yes, there's quite a famous case. There's a scientist in China called He Jiankiu, who he actually went to prison because he announced kind of out of the blue at this international conference that he had, he said, successfully edited some embryos. And, the reason being that he was experimenting, he wanted to prove that there was a way to make sure humans, we could edit out the ability for humans to develop or carry HIV. And he succeeded. He said these twin baby girls were born and they were healthy, but the scientific community was horrified because he'd crossed this line by editing the actual embryos of these babies. And the difference is so this is germline editing. Our sperm and egg cells are where all of our genetic information is carried down through the generations. So if you edit an embryo, that difference will be passed on to the next generation. Whereas with somatic editing, so that's when you edit a person after they've been born, so that's surface level, if you like, that change wouldn't be carried down through the generations. It's only by editing the sort of the germline that change could take place. So he's effectively messed with nature. He's changed the natural path of evolution in a way. And the problem with that is we just don't know the full impacts of that. We don't know what it means for these two girls, we don't know what it means for their descendants 100 years, 1,000 years down the line, because it's just so new. There are lots of things to sort of talk about and lots of policies we need to work out, but we haven't really had the opportunity to explore them yet. Everyone's heard of designer babies as well, and that's a similar thing. It's this idea of, where do we draw the line? What one person thinks is okay is different to what another person thinks is okay. This scientist, He Jiankiu, I'm sure he thought that he was doing a really good thing for science, but he sort of didn't have the permission from the rest of the world to potentially change our species, if that makes sense.
And perhaps this incident really demonstrates that scientists take this very seriously, don't they?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think it's safe to say he's unusual. I think there are obviously a lot of people working in this, and I think most of them are obviously very careful and wary about the possible outcomes of editing our genes. There is some regulation. So a lot of countries have some laws that basically state that you can edit an embryo in the lab sometimes, but only for, that sort of scientific research purposes. You can't edit an embryo outside in the real world. You can't do that yet. It's only that somatic editing, the surface level editing, that we can do. But there's still lots of things to discuss, and it's not, there's not really anything stopping someone if they had the capabilities to do this. There's no way we can stop people apart from lay down the law. So it's a sort of exciting but also quite scary prospect, I think.
Yeah, perhaps we'll need to have more conversations, will we?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's the important thing, isn't it? It's about sort of making it clear the implications as well as the benefits of this kind of technology, and talking to the public about it as well, so that they feel involved and they don't feel scared by it. I know in the UK and in some other countries as well, there's something called a citizens jury, which is part of a citizens assembly, where experts are bringing together different sort of representatives, so members of the public, and they might be medical patients living with certain conditions, for example, but also, you know, lay people who don't have a scientific background necessarily. And the idea is they bring them together in a room and just talk it all out to try and get a more rounded picture of how people, the public, feel about it and what their concerns are. And the idea in the UK, this is being run with the Society of Ethics, and the idea is that we will be able to write some policy around that, so based on what the public thinks. I don't know if it's a perfect system because, you know, it's still a small sample, but at least it's a step towards making this a sort of a joint public endeavor. You know, it's, I think what turns people off the science is when they feel like they don't have a say or they don't have any control over what's happening. So I think as long as governments are just being really transparent and talking to the public about it, then that's the best way forward.
Oh yeah, for sure. And perhaps education also plays a role here, and with people not being sort of patronizing to others who do not perhaps understand all the underpinnings of a scientific field, but they still have intelligence to understand if it's presented well.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, I'm that person as well. I'm not a scientist, like I said, but I can still be interested in it. I think people are really willing and interested in it, but it is a really complicated it's a very deep and complex science when you really sort of look into how it all works. So it's understandable that people don't know about it or exactly what it all means, what the terms mean. It's like a lot of things. It's probably easy if you're working in it and you already know about it all, but for us outsiders, it's very reasonable to admit that you don't really understand what's going on. I think I felt the same way a few years ago.
So where do we go from here? What's the perspectives for the near and maybe far future?
In terms of where we go with allowing genomics sort of into our lives, I think we sort of proceed with caution is the answer. I mean, hopefully these civic discussions, the people's sub-juries will help to at least show decision makers how people feel about it. But, you know, at the same time, we have to kind of push forward with the science. I think one researcher sort of put it to me, we would regret it if we were too cautious. You know, if we, for example, with climate change, yes, okay, if we're editing the genomes of some plants, some people might say, oh, but that's not natural, we don't know what's going to happen, what's the outcome of that will be in the long run. But actually, we don't have that much time to try and counteract climate change, so maybe our future selves would regret it if we didn't start experimenting now. It's different with humans, obviously, but it does go to show, you know, we have this knowledge, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. You can't pretend that we don't have the knowledge now. You know, it's here, so we have to embrace it to an extent. We just have to make sure that the way we do that is done in a really fair and transparent way, and involves as many different people as possible.
And what would you would like to see in the future of genomics?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd hope that it would sort of improve just our general health and well-being. I do like the idea of having all our genome sequenced on a database so that my doctor could tell me, you know, even just this hay fever medicine will be good for you and this one won't. That would be great, just so that we don't waste so much time and money on things that don't work. I think it's really exciting. You know, I'm aware that I keep talking about the ethical consequences, and I do sort of put lots of caution into the book when I write about it. But overall, I am really optimistic. I think it's a fantastic technology. There are lots of benefits and positives to be gained from it. I also feel very positive about the changes that are taking place in terms of plants and climate change. And I think, yeah, it's all very exciting. I'm not convinced by designer babies, but, you know, that's a whole different ballpark.
Yeah, perhaps in the conservation movement, genomics can also play some role, for example, preserving some of the species that we are really losing very fast, some of them.
Yeah, for sure. It's a really interesting example. You might have heard about, there's a man called George Church in the US who wants to bring back the woolly mammoth, which has been extinct for however many thousands of years. And when I first read that, like a lot of people, I thought, well, that's just insane. Why would you bother? You can maybe try to preserve species that are endangered now is one thing, but why would you bring back this ancient animal? But actually, it's a very interesting case, because so woolly mammoths, they had played quite an important role in the sort of preservation of the permafrost in Siberia, because they would trample down on all of these plants and things, and that sort of condensed the ice, and the nutrients all kind of stayed into the ground. I'm telling this in a very bad way, but you know, that's the idea, and that's why one of the many reasons why they were very useful for the environment they lived in. We obviously now have a huge problem with the melting of permafrost in the Northern Hemisphere. So George Church is saying, well, we could actually bring back sort of Arctic elephants using elephants, certain species of elephants, and introduce these certain traits to create a sort of super species of elephant / mammoth that would thrive in that environment and once again help to condense the permafrost. So you can see the argument. Again, it's a bit sci-fi, but there are lots of possibilities, and maybe one day it won't seem too crazy.
Oh, wow. I never knew about the role of mammoths in preserving permafrost.
No, me neither. No, you just think of them as these kind of cartoon characters, and but actually they, like a lot of animals, they had a really important role. So yeah, conservation is definitely going to be important, and hopefully that's something genomics can help with.
So we already discussed some of it, but just thinking about the bigger picture and your reflections of how is genomics important in our lives and how will it be important later on for the whole of our society?
Well, I think we've touched on a lot of ways, but, you know, in terms of our health, it's going to be really important. It's already helping researchers in the way of, you know, cancer research to work out the ways that cancer spreads, for example. It's going to hopefully help us to live longer and healthier lives, but it's not just about us directly, right? It's about the environment, and if it means that we can perhaps start to undo some of the damage that we've kind of done to the planet over the last couple of hundred years through, you know, industrial revolutions and all that stuff, then that's going to be a really positive thing. In my mind, you know, maybe on the one hand, it does feel unnatural to go editing and changing things, but actually we've already changed so much about our planet. So if it means that we can change things in a way that brings it back to how it should be, kind of redresses that balance, then that's got to be a good thing.
Oh, that's an excellent point. And even thinking about our agriculture and our domesticated animals, they're so different to their ancestors.
Yeah, of course. We've been genetic editing in a sense, or we've been selectively breeding for centuries. So it's kind of a part of who we are as humans. It's part of all of our cultures to do that. So we can't really say that this is, obviously it's a new technology comparatively, but it's not a new concept. So when you think about it like that, maybe it is kind of natural to, well, it's a natural part of human curiosity, isn't it, to want to selectively breed and make our lives better, even if it's just by having pedigree pets.
And what discoveries in your research during writing your book Genomics surprised you the most?
I think just the scale of it. You know, I had no idea. I knew that this was something that was being used in health research for sure, but I just had no idea of the sort of scale of the impact. You know, there's so many things as well that I couldn't include in the book because I only had so many words that I could use. It's so many other industries I'd love to write more about. You know, they use it now in forensics, in solving crimes, for example. It's such an interesting case of, I don't think I can think of any other example of a technology that it can be so widely applied to so many different areas. It's just huge.
And did you have your genome sequenced? Did you want to see maybe if you were susceptible to caffeine addiction or something like that?
Yeah, I did. I actually got it sequenced a few years ago for a different news story that I was writing. And I sort of forgot about it, or, you know, I tucked it away for a while. And so when I was writing this book, I thought, oh, I wonder if I have the login. I'll go and see, look into my data again. And it's really funny. It's such a, I mean, it's really useful on the one hand. You know, it can tell you, luckily I apparently don't carry like the BRCA1 or 2 genes that can lead to breast cancer. That's really fantastic to know. But it also tells you all sorts of things that I had never thought about. Like, for example, whether you have wet or dry earwax, whether you can smell asparagus in your urine. Apparently that's a genetic trait. So many things, and those are clearly the most sort of useless things that have stuck in my brain. There are plenty more, but yeah, it's interesting. I think that's, yeah, more and more people are doing it, aren't they? It's a very fun exercise. I think people are naturally curious about what it is that makes them unique, and yeah, having your genome sequenced like that is definitely one way of finding out.
Well, this has been a fascinating and very informative discussion. So what are you working on now, and what will be your next project?
Oh, well, I'd like to write another book one day, but so I actually wrote two at once during a pandemic, and that was quite intense. So I'm very much enjoying a bit of a break from books for now. I'm still writing articles about science and research for magazines like Wired. And I will definitely continue to do that over the summer. But it's nice to take a bit of a break from book work. I've been doing lots of publicity for it. As I mentioned, the learning about how to do a TikTok and all of that kind of thing. So yes, for now, I think I'm just going to maybe take a holiday and take on some lighter work.
Work on those dance moves.
Exactly.
And what's the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Thanks. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. That's probably the best way of getting me. I'm just at Rachel Pells. And the book is called Genomics, How Genome Sequencing Will Change Our Lives. It's published by Penguin Cornerstone. You can buy it. You can see different ways to buy it on the Penguin website. But it's in all, in the UK, it's in all good bookshops. And it's online on Amazon, Hive, all of the usual places.
Excellent. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been really fun.